Hello and welcome to the Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology's macronutrient module. Today we're going to look at protein sources in the diet. And it's an exciting topic, and it's something that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about, and you're going to need to really get so that you can explain to your clients, like, where do they get their protein? So before we begin, just to make sure that you remember that this is not medical advice and this is to be used by people in conjunction with working with a qualified healthcare practitioner. It's not diagnosing, not treating. We're just kind of pointing out to you what the role of protein is in your clients' diets, how you can assess it, how you can give them good information about how to optimize their protein. So let's take a look at what factors might contribute to a person becoming deficient in protein. We hear a lot about, you have to eat a certain amount of meat or you have to eat a certain amount of grams of protein a day. But what's the reality of it? How many people are deficient in protein because they don't eat enough? It's usually not a matter of not eating enough, because if somebody eats a calorie sufficient diet, as long as it's whole foods, they're going to get enough protein. So the people you worry about if you're getting not enough protein are people who don't eat right or picky eaters. There are also people who have low hydrochloric acid in the stomach. And in the digestive module, we go through way more detail about what that is and what cells produce it and how you can optimize it. But when somebody has low hydrochloric acid, they can't digest the protein very well. Proteins and minerals require that there be a good source of acid in the stomach in order for them to be broken down and absorbed by the body. So if there's low acid in the stomach, which is actually quite a common problem as people age, then there could be a deficiency of protein. And we'll learn ways to look at blood tests to analyze what those are. So deficient pancreatic enzymes. The pancreas is the gland kind of organ. It's one of those hybrids that has some glandular function, and it's an endocrine gland, it's an exocrine gland, and it's an organ. So the pancreas produces enzymes to help break down the food. So the protease enzymes break down the protein, the amylase breaks down the starch, and the lipase breaks down the fat, the cellulase breaks down the cellulose, although not very efficiently. If you're deficient, or if your client is deficient in pancreatic enzymes, in particular the protease enzymes, then they will be low in protein because a lot of the protein that they're eating just isn't getting digested and absorbed. Also, poor liver function can contribute to a deficiency of protein. The amino acid metabolism is controlled in the liver. So the movement, the change between one amino acid and another, the combination of those together has a lot to do with what's going on in your liver. Another thing that can impair protein absorption and utilization and the movement from one protein to another, the amino acids that get formed together, is vitamin B6 deficiency, because it's a cofactor for the manufacture of many of the non-essential amino acids. So a person may have a certain amount of protein in the diet, but not enough of the actual amino acids. And really, when you're looking at people, you don't want to look at, are they deficient in protein? It's more amino acids if you're looking from a dietary perspective. So because inevitably the protein has to get broken down and utilized. If you were to take, say, 50 grams of amino acids and take them into the system, and if it was in the right balance for your body tissues, that would be much more efficient and much more equivalent to protein than if you took 50 grams of protein in, say, you know, steak or animal products. And then any kind of infection or severe physical trauma can use up the protein stores. Why do you think that is? Well, it's because when you are having a trauma, there's going to be repair that needs to happen. There's tissues that have to actually be built back up. We have to be able to form collagen, and that takes having a sufficient amino acids. And then finally, bacterial and viral infections, well, they're going to create an influx of immunoglobulins. And immunoglobulins are antibodies, and those are proteins. So you could see that protein deficiency is, I don't believe it's real common, but I think that when these other situations happen, it makes it more of a problem. So let's take a quick look at protein requirements. it's really hard to just say an adult female needs, you know, 20 grams of protein or 50 grams of protein a day, and an adult male needs 100. Well, there's all different size adult males and females. There's different activity levels. So we can't really just blanketly say this is how much. But these are the things that have been in the literature, so you will run across it. They'll say the RDA is 0.36 grams per pound. That's the official government standard. 0.36 grams per pound. So that's approximately a gram for every 3 pounds of body weight. So if someone weighs, say, 120 pounds, and you divide that by 3, you get 40. So that person probably needs about 40 grams of protein. Whereas if they weigh 200 pounds, 200 divided by 3 is going to give you, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of close to 70. So that's the way you do it. And then if persons are more athletic, like it said that 0.6 to 0.9 grams per pound. Again, it goes by pound. Paleo diets look at 1 gram per pound, and they're very, very heavily meat-oriented. The zone diet says protein should be 30% of calories, regardless of the amount. According to WebMD, there's a bunch of guidelines, and infants just need little 10 grams a day, whereas pregnant or lactating women need all the way up to 71 grams a day. Teenage boys, we think of them as growing really fast. They're estimated, according to WebMD, not, you know, like it's the most reputable source, but 52 grams a day, teenage girls 46, adult men 56, adult women 46. It's really not a whole lot of protein. And when you start to look at where it comes from in a whole foods, high plant-based diet, whoa, it's really not that hard to get. The problem usually is the digestion. So let's look at how cooking affects protein. Heating and beating cause denaturation and coagulation. Heating is obvious what that is. It's baking it, it's frying it. Actually, the picture on here is cooking it over a barbecue, and that's like the worst way. Charbroiled meat is just really horrendous in terms of toxins. But it, basically heating and then beating is like, say you take an egg and you open it up and you start beating it around before you make it. That beating of the egg and the yolk, in addition to oxidizing the cholesterol and making it damaging, it actually messes up with the structure of the egg white and could cause them to coagulate or denature. So let's look at what those things mean. Denaturation changes the shape of the protein and decreases its ability to dissolve in liquid. Coagulation causes the protein molecules to clump together, and then they're harder to get uptake into the tissue where they're needed. Overcooking, as you can well imagine, is going to destroy things, heat-sensitive amino acids. The bonds between them can change the shape of the protein. So we really want to watch for that. And also, it makes them, some of them, resistant to digestive enzymes. So they aren't able to be broken down, basically because the shape is changed of the molecules, and that's not what those digestive enzymes are looking for. So there are times when people will need higher protein, and you need to be able to assess that and talk to them about how to handle it. So things like a muscle wasting disease, yes, you want to get to the underlying cause of what that is, but sometimes it's a vicious cycle that they can't exercise because their muscles are wasting, and their muscles are wasting because they can't exercise. Is that going very slowly and at their own pace is going to make a huge difference. So in muscle wasting and weight loss conditions, definitely going to need a higher repair, frequent infections, severe severe edema as well. So if somebody's on a weight loss diet, right, they're restricting their calories to maybe 1,000 less than they actually are burning so that they can drop some weight. If they're doing that and they're not being really careful about the protein, they're still taking proportionally the same amount of protein, it's absolutely not going to be enough. So that's time to really look at that, at it. fatigue and weakness when somebody's really, really wiped out. Oftentimes there are some protein issues, but it, again, it's a self-propagating cycle there. Frequent infections, again, an issue where people need more protein to try to make the immunoglobulins to protect them. Severe anemia and fluid retention could require a higher protein so that the liquids don't suck out into the joint spaces and the muscles. When you have a child who's growing slowly, of course you have to look at, are they eating gluten? Are they eating other allergens, which will absolutely affect the way they grow? But it's something that's worth checking into. Bruising and burns and competitive athletes, they all need extra, a little bit extra. It's not as much extra as you might have been led to believe. I don't believe that anybody really needs 200 grams of protein, but they may need over 100 in times of specific stress, whether it's work stress, home stress, or physical stress. Let's move into looking at how you can assess whether the person you're working with has some protein insufficiency issues. So the first thing you want to look at is, how much protein are they taking in? Take a look at their diet records. You can run it through a program like fitday.com or any other program that you might have, just to get an idea of how many grams of protein are they taking in, and is that sufficient for their level of activity, for their age, for their needs in terms of, are they in a healing process? Have they just been traumatized, had an accident? Do they have some other issues going on with their gut? So you really have to look at how much are they taking in compared to how much they need. And that's kind of a guess. There's some formulas which we shared already. The other thing to look at is the adequacy of their stomach acid. Now, there are some fancy tests you can do to check that. We talk about that in the digestive module, but they're expensive. There's the Heidelberg test. They're inconvenient. There's the one where they drop this a string attached to a pH paper down and swallow it and then have to pull it back up. Most people don't want to do that. But really what you want to look at is symptomatology. And you've got access to a bunch of forms and scorecard type of questionnaires that say, you know, given they get a certain score on this, it looks like they may have excess stomach acid or insufficient stomach acid. Insufficient stomach acid is really where they're going to be at if they have protein insufficiency. And it's so common. Those stomach acid levels go down as we age. And there's so many things that affect the stomach acid in terms of the kind of foods people are eating, some of the substances they're taking in, some of the drugs they take, etc. So really assessing, do you suspect that they have low stomach acid? That would help you to know whether they're good on their protein. You also then want to look at pancreatic enzyme status. Well, how do you test that? Well, that's not an easy thing to test either. So it's a guessing. It's a looking at some of the questionnaires. Are they having bloating and gas, and what's the timing of that after meals? Do they seem like they're taking in really good levels of foods but not getting it, showing signs of deficiencies? And the other thing that you could do is do a stool analysis. A lot of the stool analyses are functional analysis. So they look not only for bugs and imbalances in flora, but they'll look to see if there's something called elastase. Pancreatic elastase will show up in a stool analysis. So if you happen to have a stool analysis because you're suspecting gut stuff or because they've brought it in from another practitioner, then you can look at that to see and get a guess as to what their pancreatic enzyme status is. And that, again, we need protease to help digest. And how are you going to address some of these insufficiencies is, well, helping them to produce more stomach acid, helping to maybe give them some stomach acid while you're training them to produce more stomach acid, and then looking at taking in pancreatic enzymes or protease-type enzymes similar to what the pancreas would produce, or looking at how do you actually get the body to need less enzymes, meaning have more enzyme-rich food, like living foods, fermented foods, probiotic-rich and enzyme-rich foods and raw foods. The other thing that I would look for in terms of assessing somebody for protein status is signs of neurotransmitter imbalance. And we'll get further into that in our neurotransmitter brain chemistry part of the course,
But all of those neurotransmitters have as precursors amino acids, and some of them actually are amino acids. So we want to look at, do they have some depression? Do they have lack of motivation? Are they having difficulty focusing and concentrating? That might be a sign that they need more of particular neurotransmitter precursor amino acids. Again, looking at hormone insufficiency, hormones need protein in order to be produced. So if somebody's chronically low in their protein because either they're not getting it enough or they're not digesting it well enough, then you might see some hormone insufficiencies. And sometimes hormone insufficiencies clear up by simply addressing the nutritional needs, and one of those would be protein. You want to look at healing and immune issues. If they tend to have nails that don't grow, brittle nails, if they tend to have wounds that don't heal quickly, if they tend to be chronically ill over and over again, it's possible that they have protein insufficiency. So you want to make sure that you explore that and look for other signs and experiment with it. When I'm, on the edge and not sure, sometimes I'll just recommend somebody get some extra protein powder, just see how they do with it. See how well that works for them. And sometimes when they're low, they need a concentrated source of the protein. Sometimes they just need individual amino acids. And the need for individual amino acids is based on nutrition, but also on their genetics. They just may have a problem with certain pathways, with the synthesis of certain proteins from amino acids, proteins within the body. Clues to vitamin and mineral status. If they've got low protein into status because of lack of digestion, you're also going to see vitamin and mineral imbalances as well. So you want to look for that. You also can look at blood and urine tests. You can do blood and urine tests for amino acids, and then there's other signs on the blood test, on a standard blood chem, that will say whether or not this person is adequately digesting protein. Again, they're indirect measures, but they certainly can be helpful. And in terms of urine tests, there's the 24-hour collection of urine for testing amino acids, but there's also organic acids. And we'll be going into way more detail into those in the appropriate module. So let's look at a little bit on the blood assessment of protein status. We'll go way more into the detail of the blood testing when we get to that module, but I just want you to have a sense of what kind of things could indicate low protein, because you will have access to people's blood tests, whether you invite them to order it through directlabs.com or through their own doctors, or it's labs that they've brought in and said, "Hey, this is the lab stuff that my doctor ran. Does this give me any nutritional clues?" And then you take out your hat, thinking hat, and you say, "Yes, of course it does." So the things you're looking for as indicators of low blood protein, or low protein status in the body, I should say, is low protein, obvious, duh. Also, low albumin, high or low globulin, BUN low generally, creatinine low, and uric acid low. So any of these indicators that are low would be an indicator that they might have low protein in the body. Well, obviously with protein and albumin, they do have low protein in the body. So other blood indicators that might suggest that they have low stomach acid would be low in terms of some of their minerals, right? So calcium's low, iron's low. With stomach acid, BUN can be high or low. Chloride is often low. Carbon dioxide is often high, and that's a measure of acid alkaline residue in the body. And a high carbon dioxide could indicate that they don't have enough stomach acid to do the alkaline minerals. So hemoglobin is often low, but then MCV and MCH and MCHC, which are usually suggestions of, it's the size of the red blood cells, which tend to suggest folate and B12 insufficiencies. Also, phosphorus low, and of course, the standards protein, albumin, and globulin would be low, and globulin high or low is usually the case. So, but oftentimes it's high. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a sense of where the protein comes from in food, but how much? Because it's a lot of people think, oh, you just got to eat half a cow to get enough of protein. And realistically, when you look at some of the RDA numbers we looked at earlier, the high ones were in the 72 range for pregnant women. Now, of course, if somebody's very athletic, it may be higher. If somebody's a burn victim, it could be higher. It could be 100 grams a day. It could be people who have leaky gut might need it a little bit higher. Phase two detoxification problems could be a little higher because they need those amino acids for doing those processes or for doing the repair. But in general, if we figure a normal size weight woman, 120 pounds, say, would need maybe 60 grams at the highest, unless she's like a super competitive athlete and is lifting lots of weights and doing it daily and she's a bodybuilder, maybe she needs 80. So really not all that much. So here's looking at some of the meats, which are, obviously the higher sources, all the way from tuna at the top and for 4 ounces, down to sardines at the bottom for 22. Some of these numbers are a little bit off because they are, they're not all 4 ounces. The sardines are a little bit less, probably because that's how much they have in a can and that's how people usually eat them. But in general, between 23 and 33 grams of protein per serving. Well, that's decent. That's like half of the requirement and probably more than half of what really is required. Okay. And this is from WH Foods, by the way. There's a link there. Really excellent website and resource for you if you want to look up where to find nutrients in certain foods. They stuck in here soybean right in the middle there because a cup of soybeans, and I'm assuming that means cooked because most people aren't eating them raw. So a cup of cooked soybeans, 28 grams. So a cup of cooked beans is not a tremendous amount. So it's not an unreasonable thing. Tofu is probably more concentrated. Tempeh is probably more concentrated because it's packed into a denser way. So soy is a good source of protein and so's animal flesh. So I stuck the soy in the middle of that just so you could see how it compares. Dairy products are typically saying, oh yeah, they're great sources of protein. In reality, a cup of yogurt has about 8 grams, 8.5, cheese has 7, eggs have 6.29, and cow's milk has 3.484 in 4 ounces. People would typically eat drink a cup of cow's milk, so say 8. So all of these are in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 grams of protein per serving. Okay, so we're just looking for comparison because you want to be able to give people. We don't recommend the dairy products because I just believe they're mucus forming and they are inflammatory and they cross-react with gluten and they can cause all kinds of problems in the body and they're known to be problematic, and you can look into more of that. And we'll go into more of that when we do our food religions kind of course work. So here's looking at legumes. Legumes are beans, right? The bean family. There's a lot of them in there. And a typical serving size might be a whole cup. Obviously, miso, we're not going to eat 4 ounces in a sitting, and we're not going to take 4 ounces of soy sauce at a sitting unless you like your food really salty. So you got to keep in mind when you're looking at these nutrition charts, just the amounts. And I just copied these straight from WH Foods because they've done all the research, and I could have looked them up and done it, but they're a good source, and I'm promoting them and sending you on your way to look at them. And I actually bought their biggest big fat book just so I have it on my desk. So if I'm doing some research and wanting to create some of these charts, I can. But looking at this, so miso and soybeans and soy sauce are at the top, but obviously nobody's going to eat that quantity in one sitting. So let's look realistically. A cup of beans, a cup of lentils. In some cases, I watch the way my kids eat. They probably eat 2 cups of lentils in a sitting, or 2 cups, or at least a cup and a half of cooked beans. They're loading it up in their tacos, or they're putting a big load of it on their plate, or having a big bowl of chili. So, 1 to 2 cups would be a serving size for a robust growing person. A cup would be certainly the minimum that anybody would eat at a time. And look how much protein is in there. So 17 grams, starting with lentils, down to 14 grams per cup on garbanzos. So you compare that to the dairy products, is actually about double the dairy products. So if people say that dairy products, you have to have dairy, it's a really good source of protein, your legumes are better sources. And quite frankly, they're not that far off of the flesh. So if somebody's vegetarian and you're working with somebody vegetarian and they need more protein in their diet, these legumes are a good source. Now, some people will end up with gas and bloating from the legumes because they don't tolerate them real well. And you got to take that into account when you're dealing with what to put somebody on food-wise in order to get their protein. But you can sprout them, at least lentils and mung beans, which aren't listed here. Mung beans and adjuki beans, they're probably just, you know, they're up there. They're just not listed on this chart. So I would look those up separately in a different spot, see how much is in there. And if you actually, if somebody did eat 2 cups, like my son eating his lentil soup, he's getting about 34, 35 grams of protein in that meal, which compares very favorably and is actually higher than most of the animal flesh, the 4 ounces of animal flesh. And I'd much personally rather see him eating lentils. I think they have far more other redeeming values, and they're cleaner, and it's and all that. And he's been vegan since birth, and he's robust and big muscles and very healthy and very strong, and you know, one of the fastest kids in his lifeguarding class. And he's really is getting plenty of protein because he eats hummus, and he gets plenty of garbanzo beans and tahini, which is a good source, and lentils, and he eats pinto beans and all the other kind of beans, and he eats a ton of vegetables. So we'll see in a little bit that vegetables are good sources of protein too. So here's a listing of the amount of protein in serving size, what they consider a serving size of spinach. Now, if you're anything like me, you're putting at least 4 cups, if not sometimes 8 cups of greens into a smoothie. And if you're juicing, you're certainly juicing a heck of a lot more than a cup, because that would give you a couple of little ounces in the cup. So, you know, the myth that it propagates is that you need to have either flesh foods or concentrated vegan sources, the beans, in order to get enough protein. And quite frankly, if you're a smoothie maker, or if you are someone who likes to make a whole bunch of vegetables in a pot and steam them and then blend them up and make a soup, you're getting a ton of protein. So if I look at spinach, say I put 2 cups of spinach, which is not very much, and then I put a couple of cups of collard greens, and then I put a couple of stalks of broccoli in, and a couple of cups of kale. That's, I can make my day of smoothies that way. I just think I added up probably 30 grams of protein. And I've done the nutritional analyses on some of my smoothies and soups, and I generally get somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30, depending on how much I'm making. One of the things I love to do for dinner is steam up a big pot of broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage, and then blend it up and put some coconut and some Thai seasonings in there, or other kinds of seasonings, and make a delicious soup. Well, I typically have way more than a cup of broccoli. I'll generally have probably 3 or 4 cups of broccoli in there. So you see there, they're right there, 3.4 times 4, it's almost 15 grams just from the broccoli. The cabbage, I usually have at least a couple of cups of cabbage in there, and we're looking at another 5, so we're up to 20 already on the protein. I'll have kale, either I'll have the kale blended up in there, but usually I'll keep the baby kale small and I'll pour that in, I'll use that raw, but in any case, at least another cup there, right? And then if I throw in some sea vegetables, and if I throw in some mushrooms, right? So this is adding up. This is adding up tremendously. And then if you just take a 1/4 cup of pumpkin seeds, why this was put in the vegetables column, I don't know, but pumpkin seeds are a great source of zinc. They're a good source of fat. 180 calories per 1/4 cup, not bad. You put that in and you make a cream of something soup with pumpkin seed as the cream of, you just added almost 10 grams of protein. So let's add that up. So say I make a cream, let's just say I make a cream of broccoli soup, and I use the 1/4 cup of pumpkin seeds, and I use 2 or 3 cups of, say I use 3 cups of broccoli and a cup of cabbage, okay? So what do we have there? Maybe I'll throw some spinach in there because spinach is great. So I'll throw in 2 cups of spinach, 2 cups of broccoli, and a cup of cabbage. And so that would be 11 plus 8 is 19 plus, that's 20. Let's say 20 on the vegetables alone and then another 9 on the pumpkin seeds. That's 30 grams of protein right there. So really, you know, if your clients are going to be like, oh, where do I get my protein? I keep, you know, I want to do this diet, or I want to fast or cleanse or whatever, and how am I going to get enough protein? People say that all the time to me when they're doing a green cleanse. How am I going to get enough protein? Well, I'm just saying, follow the recipes, add it all up. It'll come up to at least 60 grams, if not 100 grams of protein. And it's good, easy to digest protein. So yeah, people, I'm not saying everybody has to be vegetarian or vegan, but I'm saying there's no reason to worry about protein on a vegan diet. There's plenty of it. There's no reason to stock up and have to feel like you need to eat tons of beans in order to get it, especially if you fart when you eat beans, or your clients say, I can't eat beans because they get gassy. Then with the vegetables, and when you teach them to do blended soups and smoothies and juices, woo, tons of protein. So put it to bed, put it to sleep. Really, you know, feel comfortable with this. So here's just a little list of some of the proteins and seeds and how they break down, like how much carb, protein, and fat. So a lot of people will say, well, I'm vegan, I'm raw. I get my protein from my nuts and seeds. Well, yeah, you do get some protein, but mainly you get fat. And that's good as long as it's not an out of balance fat. But a lot of folks really just drink a lot of almond milk, eat a lot of walnuts and pecans, which are sixes. And as we learned in the fat module, if you haven't watched that, go back and watch that one. As we learned in the fat module, you've got to make sure you balance the omega-3s and 6s. Really important. And on this chart right here that we're looking, protein and nuts and seeds, the ones that have the most omega-3s would be the flax seeds and secondarily walnuts. And this was just taken from specific lists. We could add hemp seeds to it. We could add chia. They're all good sources. And I would encourage you, you know, to really get comfortable with how much protein is in that, you know, quarter cup or 2 tablespoons or whatever of chia, so that you could easily feed back to people and say, look, this is good stuff. These are good sources. So let's just look at some of these common nuts and seeds that we would typically recommend to people for lots of reasons. You know, chia and hemp, I put chia and hemp in my breakfast. So I'll typically soak a quarter cup of chia in about 5 cups of water or more, and that will be an amazing porridge. So 12 grams of protein, that's pretty darn good. Add some hemp seeds, you know, and I might not add a full quarter cup of hemp seeds, maybe I put 2 cups in there, 2 tablespoons or 1/2 cup. So that would give me 5, right? And if I sprinkle some flax seeds on there, maybe 2 tablespoons of flax seeds, there's another 4. So that's already 20 just there. So this just gives us an idea of how much actual protein is in these foods, right? The higher the fat nut, the lower the protein content. We see cashews at the bottom. But this is good stuff. This is good stuff to know. Grains are also a source of protein, you know, and not very very much, but we're looking at 12% in buckwheat and 11% in millet and 15% in oats and 15% in quinoa. So they're good sources. And if your client tolerates grains, they don't have a cross reactivity to gluten, or they are not really carbohydrate sensitive or glycemic sensitive, insulin resistant, then this is going to be good sources of some additional protein. And then again, we're looking at percentages. So where split peas are up and the legumes are up in the 25-27%, as opposed to in the 12 vicinity for the grains. So you see, where do you get your protein? It's not that hard. It really isn't that hard. And I encourage you to just really get familiar with this. So when somebody is questioning it, you give them really good answers. And you can use things, like I said, online. There's fitday.com. There's others where you can just plug in a day or two of their intake. Or what you can do is make up some recipes or use some of my recipes if you want to give them and run them through one of those programs to say, look, if you drink this smoothie, if you make the smoothie and you have half of it in the morning and half of it in the afternoon, you're going to get whatever, 60 grams of protein. And then if they need a little extra, then they can go with the protein powders. And there are some good high quality protein powders. And in our next presentation, we're going to look in depth at some of those protein powders, the pros, the cons, when you would need them, when you would not need them, and how much protein is actually in them. So our last slide is on looking at percentage wise, how much of the various vegetables are protein. And asparagus is up there with the legumes at 27%. You may think, well, I don't eat all that much asparagus. But if you make cream of asparagus soup, cream of asparagus with mushroom soup even. I have a wonderful recipe with asparagus and tomatoes and some really cool spices, and it's blended and it's really, really delicious. But yeah, if you do a whole bunch of it, you can get quite a bit of protein. 27%. Beets are only 11% because they're higher in carbs. They're a lot sweeter. But mushrooms, 37% of their calories are from protein. Can you imagine? So yeah, make yourself a cream of broccoli soup with mushrooms or asparagus soup. Broccoli, 20% protein. Zucchini, 18.5%. And there are some other charts that show kale and spinach tend to be up there in the 40% protein. So it's good stuff. And you can help your client get lots of good quality protein without the residues, the toxic residues of excess nitrogenous waste that they will get when they consume too much in the animal protein side. Again, I'm not saying that everybody has to be vegan and you have to get them off of that. I mean, I think there's definite advantages for some people in some many situations, and some people feel like they psychologically don't want to let go of it, and they're physiologically, their bodies have adapted so they don't do as well. Part of that is detox, and you got to work with them on that. But what I'm saying here is, you don't need to be sitting there and saying, oh, you can't be vegan, you have to get your protein. Where are you going to get it from? You know now, where do you get your protein? So this is Dr. Rita Marie, and I'll see you on the next video.